KALW.
In the last 10 to 15 years, we have seen certainly a rise of rightist extremist violence, a change in rhetoric.
Can the past inform us about the assassination attempt on former President Trump?
And regardless of your politics, you have to be concerned about this.
Looking back at a bloody year in American politics, then why did an artist create 15-foot-tall cat monoliths?
The catoliths are idols of the ancient space cats.
Plus, we learn about the challenges and joys of living with disabilities.
It would be a great pleasure if it was here, because there is joy in being disabled.
A chat with actor and activist Alice Wong. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Long before the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump last weekend, the level of political anxiety in the country, specifically concerns about political violence, has been rising as the nation prepares to go to the polls this fall. The elevated political rhetoric and threat of widespread violence in the lead-up to this fall's presidential elections reminds some scholars of another inflection point, the bloody year of 1968.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who won the California primary last night, had just completed making his victory speech in the ballroom of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. He then started to move out to return to his suite when he was shot.
That year began with the nation mired in war, then shaken by the assassinations of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Democratic presidential candidate and U.S. Senator Robert F. Kennedy. The year witnessed racial and social strife across the country. Then a beleaguered President Lyndon Johnson gave way to Richard Nixon the following year. Dr. David McEwen is a political science professor at Sonoma State University and scholar on American politics. He's been studying recent political trends within the national electorate as the nation heads to the polls in November. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid recently spoke to McEwen about the increase in violent political rhetoric and the rise in social anxiety many Americans are feeling.
Last week, we had the Supreme Court essentially gave former President Trump immunity. We had the assassination attempt against him. We had Judge Cannon basically dismissing the case on the stolen documents. And there is tremendous anxiety in the country. I was 10 years old in 1968. I remember the assassination of Dr. King, and I remember the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. And it seems like we were at an inflection point where we could have gone up and we sort of went down after that. Do you see similarities between 1968 and now as far as the anxiousness and the fear of many Americans?
You know, I think that's a great place to start. I was born in 1968 in East Bay in Berkeley. That time, you know, Berkeley was a huge place of activity. And if you think back in the Bay Area, even in the 1970s, there was a lot going on, right? Patty Hearst, SLA, there were bombings going on with different groups in the East Bay. The Panthers active. You had right-wing, left-wing groups. You had things going on with Puerto Rican nationalists in New York City. It was a time of great upheaval, really from the period of about 68 until about the mid-1970s. And then we move to the late 1970s, right? Son of Sam. There's a lot happening in terms of violence in the United States. We have been to this place before, but this is also different. And that's because in 1968, there was a political earthquake that happened. Obviously, the war, civil rights movements, environmental movement, women's movement, but also the election of Richard Nixon for what was going on. And that was a huge inflection point for our politics. Ronald Reagan was 2 years into his term as California's governor. You fast forward, and we have seen a change in violence, a change in extremism that really started with the election of Barack Obama and the rise of rightist extremism that had reached an inflection point, certainly on January 6, 2021. And has continued. So if you look at the history of the United States, as someone who teaches about political violence, terrorism, and law, we see that there are differences that have occurred over time. But in the last 10 to 15 years, We have seen certainly a rise of rightist extremist violence, a change in rhetoric. And the worry for scholars like myself is that this rise of extremism becomes the new normal. This normalization of rhetoric around violence is problematic. And regardless of your politics, you have to be concerned about this. As we reflect on this event, it is also one of those political earthquakes that upsets or changes the paradigm for where we're at. So in that sense, it's a big, big deal for what happened this past Saturday.
I wanted to go back to 1964, specifically at the Cow Palace in Daly City. That was the Republican National Convention. Barry Goldwater got the nomination. He basically rode on the coattails of his opposition to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. 4 years later, Richard Nixon basically used the Southern strategy, which has been in the playbook of the Republican parties.
If we look at Barry Goldwater and Johnson, in terms of what happened in 64, you look at not only the Civil Rights Act, you look at the Voting Rights Act, you look at recent Supreme Court decisions that have seen it stark and amazing in some ways. And yet, there are some things that I think are similar right to today. When former President Trump announces Nance, author and new U.S. senator, as his running mate, he is hearkening back to that Southern strategy, but in the Rust Belt, to capture states like, for example, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Minnesota, as well as Wisconsin. But it's Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin that Joe Biden has to win to get to 270. I'm part of a national project of political scientists who are looking at the arrest records of those from that period of time. And we find that they are big proponents of the great replacement theory, right? They are red voters living in blue areas or areas that have changed a lot and they're frustrated and they're willing to lash out. And the grievance politics that has led to some of this extremism that we see going on, all of that is a new inflection point. A lot of that is about economic standing and certainly inequality. And when we talk about those issues in the presidential election, they're quite difficult. The problem I think that gets lost here is those issues are often boring. I study a group that's known as the RAE, the Rising American Electorate. This is a set of young people, 18 to 35. They're more diverse. They're more urban. Their politics are much more liberal, but they're hugely concerned about their pocketbook and also concerned about climate change and also concerned about how you treat people who don't look like yourself because they know that that's wrong. All of this clashes, and the habitual electorate is still older, whiter. It's a little less than 2 out of 3 regular habitual voters, and that is a clash that we see right now. And that's going on into 24 to 28. And it's a huge pattern that challenges both dominant parties. All of that, I think, is that clash that's leading to a rise of extremism. And we just have to be careful.
Bringing it back to political violence, we saw an assassination attempt against President Ford, an assassination attempt against President Reagan. We saw an assassination attempt on Saturday against former President Trump. And of course, we saw January 6th. We saw the violence around the Black Lives Matters. What can we expect going into November and even beyond?
We can expect a moment of unity. We can expect a temporary kind of moment where we're all slowing things down and saying, look, this isn't right, and we have to come together. The problem is the calendar quickly takes over for the most important election since maybe 1860, at least that's my view, that this is that election. And that means that elections are about contrast, they're about difference. How you draw that is often polarizing. That is going to lead to some difficulty moving forward. The question is, whoever wins in November has to unite the country, because what's at stake is that place after 1860, where we know what happened from 1861 to 1865. It wasn't just the Civil War. It's that Americans fought Americans. And when we look at this extremism project that we work on, we see that there are a number of Americans, they're willing to ignore the law and to shoot at them, to do really bad things. So we have to pay attention to that. And that requires that the winner be gracious, the loser be gracious. And that is really going to be tough, because at base, even though the president called Donald Trump over the weekend, and even though Donald Trump talked about Joe Biden, these two don't like each other. Can they set that aside and lead us to some place that is less divisive?
Before Malcolm X was assassinated, he warned of this atmosphere of violence around the civil rights era. And he basically said that the assassination of President Kennedy was an example of the chickens coming home to roost. Are we seeing a modern reckoning as the chickens coming home to roost here in this country?
So here's my worry. We look at the data around mass shootings or celebrated shootings or events like we just saw this past Saturday, And the data tell us that within the next 10 days following, there are 2 to 3 similar type events. And violence, how that's handled, has to be coupled with accountability and coupled with leadership. Leadership is kind of hard to operationalize, to measure, to know what that looks like. But accountability, we know what that looks like. That's called the rule of law. And recognition of the rule of law is an important element. So if you're talking to the Patriots of January 6th, that's not accountability. And that does breed instability. It's not just violence, it breeds instability. And I think that's the broader worry about the consequences, because we know elections have consequences.
That was Dr. David McEwen, political science professor at Sonoma State University, speaking with KLW News editor Sunni Khalid. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. If you're walking down Montgomery Street in downtown San Francisco and you find yourself looking up at a 15-foot-tall cat, you might not be hallucinating. You might actually be standing in front of the windows of KALW's pop-up space, because right now we're showcasing a Burning Man art gallery. David Normal is the San Francisco artist behind the massive 3D-printed catoliths. KLW executive producer Ben Trefney interviewed David as part of a panel with all the artists showing pieces in our space. Here's part of that conversation. David begins with the inspiration for his art.
The catoliths are idols of the ancient space cats, the Lyran space cats. So, specifically, they could be called shards of the orb of holophilinity. Holophilinity is the universal cat consciousness. And the cats had a planet long ago called Lemuria, and it was destroyed in the disco-reptilian wars. And on that planet, before it was destroyed, they had a kind of cattopia where they lived through the power of their mind. And this is something that our terrestrial cats, Catus felis, the domestic house cat, still has an inkling of this power, the power to use its mind. So when your cat is sleeping or dreaming, well, the cat is really dreaming. The cat, when it's purring, when the cat is just doing its basic cat activities that seem innocuous, well, actually, it is, through the power of its feline mind, creating reality around you. So cats, unlike humans, humans work to do things. Like, I built these cats by 3D printing and designed them in 3D modeling, and a whole group of people helped me with all of this industry to make these cat statues. But on the ancient love planet, and it was a love planet because the cats were very hedonistic. Their first priority was pleasure. So they created
more like a lust planet?
Oh, it was very lusty, yes. And this is one of the things, is that cats have always been associated with what in anthropological terms they call fertility. So the cats have always been associated with fertility. So goddesses of ancient Egypt, like Bastet, were known as fertility goddesses. But in every, shall we say, house of ill repute, there would be a little statue of Bastet. Mm. Just so, and in current days, you know, we have the Maneki Neko, which is the good luck cat. So cats are still worshipped around the world in various ways. And in the internet, the cats preside. Cats are one of the main gods or goddesses, really. So these cats that you see here, these are cat goddesses. And they predate ancient Egypt, because we're going all the way back to Lemuria. Now, Lemuria, the continent that was in the Pacific Ocean, it takes its name from the cat planet, because it was the cats who formed Lemuria. So it was actually New Lemuria. So this is confusing, but many things about the cat world are confusing because cats really love puns and they like to purr, and purring is perhaps and perpetual and it is pergasmic. You know, the cats love to reach the pergasmic state. So these cats, they purr interactively. And that is to represent the perboration of holofelinity.
And so when it's working correctly, then when you go up onto the shelf in front of the cat, then it'll purr.
It is working correctly.
So now that it's working correctly.
When it is working correctly, it's always working correctly. If the cat isn't purring, it's not the cat's problem. It's something about you.
That's probably the case. But it's possible for us to go up on the shelf.
Up on the shelf.
And it will interact with us.
Yes, you have to perch. The cat is perching. And if you perch with the cat, because cats perch, like the Cheshire cat was perching in the tree when Alice came by. Uh-huh. And you see, the cat disappeared in sections. And you'll notice that these cats, like caryatid columns, like you know what a caryatid column is? Let me break in and tell you what a caryatid column is. Well, there's Doric, and then what's the other form of column? You have Doric and Ionic and Corinthian, and also caryatid. And a caryatid column has the shape of a woman. So I think it's at the Parthenon, there's a famous set of caryatid columns that you can see. And there are other places throughout the ancient world where caryatid columns have been built. And in some cases, the marble would be hewn in such a way that the caryatid was built in sections. So you'll see that this cat was printed in 3D sections, and it's a... Well, it's what we call making a silk purse out of a sow's ear, or a silk purr out of a sow ear.
That was artist David Normal speaking with KLW executive producer Ben Trefney. You can come visit us and check out David's Catalyths at our downtown San Francisco studio at 220 Montgomery. Our Burning Man gallery will be up for the rest of the month. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Before we go, for Disability Pride Month, we're going to hear from activist Alice Wong. She founded the Disability Visibility Project in 2014 to amplify the stories of people with disabilities in relation to media and culture. Her project led to a podcast, a collection of personal stories on living with disabilities today. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Alice Wong on the challenges and also the joys of living with a disability.
You said something that changed your life was the American Disability Act. And you said that basically helped you live the life that you had envisioned for yourself. Where were you at when that came into effect? And what were the changes that you foresaw for yourself?
So I was a sophomore at high school in 1990 with a long past. And, you know, I have to be really honest, I don't remember, noticing it. It wasn't something that registered, deeply into my brain. You know, it really wasn't until I graduated from high school and needed to go to college that I really realized, wow, you know, this law came right in time to really, you know, ensure that I do have, the ability to request reasonable accommodations. It's been a real key in order for me to go to school and get what I need and just have a law that I could call my own. Mm-hmm. I just say, hey, this is, you know, something that I would need to perform my daily activities and just not have to beg for it, even though I think the experience now is still very difficult. You know, a law doesn't change the world. You know, I think it's really about people power.
Okay, so you figured out this life that you wanted, the ADA, kind of helped you say, hey, I can make this come true.
Yeah.
Then you told your family, I want to move to California. How did your family feel when you said, I want to move to California?
I think they do, because hundreds of folks suffocated and stifled in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, hey, like, San Francisco Bay Area is such a, it's such an epicenter of, like, a huge, vibrant, active disability, you know, community. And, you know, they were the heart of where a lot of independent living movement happened. You have a large community of disabled people, just like, you know, any other community where, like, when you're seen, it's like, well, like, the vibe is different, you know.
Right.
You know, it's,
you write in your book that people with disabilities are more visible than ever.
Speaking for myself, I think the internet has been a game changer. I think the ability to blog on your own, you have a Twitter account. There are so many really, really cool, like, disabled and deaf artists that just everyday people just, you know, creating content. We don't need to write an op-ed and just, you know, cross our fingers that the editor won't put it. We should just publish our own stuff. And I think that's given so many marginalized communities a base. To be on social media does have its huge risks. I mean, it is a dumpster fire. Let's, you know.
And that's a mild way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bag of burning poop. I mean, it's, you know, when I talk about visibility, I'm not sugarcoating it. It's not even like literal visibility, right? It's about being comfortable in your own skin. But the fact that there are people who are at that place and they're telling their stories, you know, in many ways, by being visible, hopefully it gives permission to other folks who are just still figuring stuff out. Like, you're not alone, that you're not alone. One of the ways that helps is seeing yourself represented in different ways.
I know one thing that's come up for people with disabilities is for a long time, they would ask, you know, when there's events, it's like, can you stream it? At, you know, at conferences and stuff, you know, people with disabilities, I can't attend. Can you, can you stream it so I can watch it from home? And these organizations would say, oh, we don't have the capacity. That's why I say COVID is a reflection, so much of a reflection of some of the issues in this society. And now people are at home and they can't go out. And now all of these organizations and companies are streaming.
It's super interesting to see when, let's just face it, like, non-disabled people suddenly have something taken away from them. Oh, this is unfair. Oh, what are we going to do? Oh my gosh, this is, I can't believe this. We got to do something. You know, suddenly there's capacity. But disabled people ask and tell people, hey, this is problematic or this is inaccessible. Usually a few things either happen, like either they were not believed,
mm-hmm.
or complaining, or asking for too much. I think, again, the pandemic has shown, like, suddenly everybody is, you know, impacted, and they're just making things happen without really acknowledging the years of advocacy by sick and disabled people. What's also really telling during this pandemic, what kinds of people are disposable, right? I mean, this pandemic has really shown,
yes,
very much the racist and xenophobic ableist, you know, how we really feel about the people in our community, right? Like this, it's all seen as this, like, acceptable loss, right? Like, nobody's like, we don't see the country really responding it really has totally changed the systemic inequality. I mean, you see people in prisons and nursing homes dying at alarming rates, And why don't we give a shit about people who are behind bars? I mean, it's because we can't see them. It's because they're separate from us. And when you have a system that perpetuates segregation, it allows us to devalue people or just render them as invisible. And this is Black, brown, older people, disabled people. It's all interconnected.
That was activist Alice Wong speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. You can find more information about Alice's book, Disability Visibility, at KALW.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, Cherie Bishop, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shireen Adil, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.